So just as we come to our end today, I'm going to find a bit of Geoffrey Monmouth. I'll have to get near the light so I can see. I'll be right once I find it, but I can't find it at the moment. Where are we? Let's Brutus. Actually, yes, turn the light on, because I'm starting to struggle. My poor old eyes. Thank you very much. So what? So Geoffrey writes, as I say, these two books. One called "The History of the British Kings," where he tells us that the British come from Brutus, the son of Aeneas, who Aeneas being one of the founders of Rome. So he's saying that the British have this great lineage that taps back into Troy and back, therefore, into that Homeric kind of civilization. Now, one of the interesting things we find about Geoffrey of Monmouth is that he has these various hints which you think are ridiculous, right? How the hell are the Britons related to Troy and the Trojan War? That's a nonsense, surely. Because literally it is a nonsense. But when he taps this back into, when he writes at the beginning of his book and says that this is to do somewhere, this whole process around the Welsh, around the British folk soul, is to do with Troy. He takes us back to Homer. He takes us back to the magical traditions of Parmenides and the Homeric, Bronze Age Homeric traditions. So the thing about Geoffrey's works is they are books of magic, they are genuine books of magic. Within these works, not within the 18th century stuff, here you get hints if you hang out with that speak back to you. Now the whole point about the tradition of the tradition that begins with Geoffrey and continues in Black Book of Carmarthen, the Red Book of Hergest, which is contains the Mabinogi, the Book of Taliesin, the Triads. These are tale stories that speak back to us. So when he says to us that so I'll just read the very beginning. Well, actually, not the very beginning, is that his boring epistle. Chapter 2. Britain, the best of islands, is situated in the Western Ocean between France and Ireland, being 800 miles long, 200 broad. It produces everything that is useful to man, with a plenty that never fails. It abounds with all kinds of metals, and has plains of large extent and hills fit for the finest tillage, the richness of whose soil affords variety of fruits in their proper seasons. It also has forests well stocked with all kinds of wild beasts. In its lawns, cattle find good change of pasture, and bees variety of flowers for honey. Under its lofty mountains lie green meadows pleasantly situated, in which the gentle murmurs of crystal springs, gliding along clear channels, gives those that pass an agreeable invitation to lie down on their banks and slumber. It is likewise well watered with lakes and rivers abounding with fish. and beside the narrow sea, which is the Severn, of course, which is on the southern coast towards France, there are three noble rivers stretching out like three arms, namely the Thames, the Severn, and the Humber, by which foreign commodities from all countries are brought into it. It was formerly adorned with 28 cities, of which some are in ruins and desolate, others are still standing, beautified with lofty church towers, wherein religious worship is performed according to the Christian institution. It is lastly inhabited by five different nations, the Britons, Romans, Saxons, Picts, and Scots, whereof the Britons before the rest did formerly possess the whole island from sea to sea, till divine vengeance, punishing them for their pride, made them give way to the Picts and the Saxons. But in what manner and from whence they first arrived here remains now to be related in what follows. So first of all, what we see is this description of Britain as this Eden, as this magical kind of island. So we're invited, first of all, to contemplate, to participate in a meditation upon the island of Britain, upon the whole of the island of Britain. Very beautiful. And then we come to this link with Troy and the Trojan War. After the Trojan War, Aeneas, flying with Ascanius from the destruction of their city, sailed to Italy. There he was honourably received by King Latinus, which raised against him the envy of Turnus, the king of the Rutuli, who thereby made war against him. Upon their engaging in battle, Aeneas got the victory, and having killed Turnus, obtained the kingdom of Italy, and with it Lavinia, the daughter of Latinus. After his death, Ascanius, succeeding in the kingdom, built Alba upon the Tiber, and begat a son called Silvius, who in pursuit of a private amour, took to wife a niece of Lavinia. The damsel soon conceived after, and the father of Ascanius, coming to the knowledge of it, commanded his magicians to consider what sex the child should be. When they had satisfied him in the matter, they told him she would give birth to a boy who would kill his father and mother, and after travelling over many countries in banishment, would at last arrive at the highest pitch of glory. Nor were they mistaken in their predictions, for at the proper time the woman brought forth a son and died of his birth. But the child was delivered to a nurse and called Brutus. At length, after 15 years had expired, the youth accompanied his father in hunting and killed him undesignedly by the shot of an arrow. For as the servants were driving the deer towards him, Brutus, shooting at them, smote his father under the breast. Upon his death, he was expelled from Italy, his kinsmen being enraged at him for so heinous a deed. Thus banished, he went into Greece, where he followed the posterity of Helenus, son of Priamus, kept in slavery by Pandresus, king of the Greeks. For after the destruction of Troy, Pyrrhus, the son of Achilles, had brought hither in chains Helenus and many others, and to revenge upon the death of his father upon them, had given command that they be held in captivity. Brutus, finding that they were by descent his old countrymen, took up his abode among them and began to distinguish himself by his conduct and bravery in war. And so basically what he then does is to free the Trojans, and then there's a whole kind of journey where the Trojans come to Britain. And let me just find where we come to that. And again, what you have here is a mythical history connecting us with the Trojan War, connecting us with the times of Homer, and connecting us with the ancient traditions that Parmenides speaks about and that Homer writes about. Now, the whole heart of the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is what the times are being looked at, is to look at the whole processes of illusion and enchantment and the return home, return to the place of knowing and awareness. So this story that he is about to tell us, while it is at one level a political story designed to please the Norman overlords, is actually a story about the nature of our own soul and the nature of the freeing of ourselves and the returning home to our own place. Now, I'll just read you one more bit of this, because this is, and I'm going to jump down really, sort of. So this, The thing, actually, let me just see if I can find where they actually come to Britain, because it's quite fun. It's quite fun where they come on board, really. Here we go. Without further delay, with the consent of his company, he repaired to the fleet and, loading it with the riches and spoils he'd taken, set sail with a fair wind towards the promised island and arrived on the coast of Totnes. So Totnes becomes the place of where everything happens, right? It's obviously the key place. And it's the... So they arrived at... The island was then called Albion and was inhabited by none but a few giants. And they sought the giant. They sought the giants out, and then they come to the River Thames and they build London, which they call New Troy. And again, there's all kinds of magical ramifications of this, really. And in fact, it's one of the interesting things is that mazes in folklore are often in this country are often called Troy Town. So there's a whole thing there. So there's a whole then Thieves of Kings. But we come to just because. Let's really look at our one of the kings that comes to be called Leil. After him reigned Leil his son, a peaceful and just prince, who enjoying a prosperous reign, built in the north of Britain a city called Kai of Leil, the city of Leil. And at the same time, this was at the same time that Solomon began to build the Temple of Jerusalem, and the Queen of Sheba came to hear his wisdom. At which time also Silvius Epitus succeeded his father in Italy. Leil reigned 25 years, but towards the latter end of his life grew more remiss in his government, so that his neglect of affairs speedily occasioned civil dissension. After him reigned his son Hudibras, 39 years, and composed the civil, and he set away the civil dissension. He built Caerleon and Canterbury, Caer Gwyn and Winchester, and the town of Mount Paladur, now called Shaftesbury. At this time an eagle spoke while the wall of the town was being built, and indeed I should have transmitted the speech to posterity had I thought it true, as the rest of the history. So saying the eagle is a bit of a liar, is an untrustworthy, the speaking eagle that can't be relied upon. At this time reigned Capis, the son of Epitus, and Haggai, Amos, Joel, and Azariah were the prophets of Israel. Now we come to a very particular and an interesting bit. Next succeeded Bladud, his son, who reigned 20 years. He built Carbadus, now Bath, and made hot baths in it for the benefit of the public, which he dedicated to the goddess Minerva. In whose temple he kept fires and never went out, nor consumed ashes, but as soon as they began to decay, were turned into balls of stone. About this time the prophet Elias prayed that it might not rain upon earth, and it did not rain for 3 years and 6 months. This prince was a very ingenious man and taught necromancy in his kingdom. Nor did he leave off pursuing his magical operations till he attempted to fly to the upper region of the air with wings, which he had prepared, and he fell down upon the temple of Apollo in the city of Trinovantum, where he was dashed to pieces. We're going to look tomorrow really at Bladud and about the mythology around Bladud and the connection between Bladud and the tradition. But in what you get there in those few words is a concentrated magical image, a place of the undying fire. Bladud's name comes out of the Welsh, Blaid Yud. Blaid means wolf, Ud means lord. So one of the meanings of Bladud's name is Wolf Lord. And just up from Bath, in a place called Nettleton, there is a temple of Apollo Cunimaglos. And it's called Apollo the Hound, also called Apollo the Wolf. And so, So what we see here, the sense of Bladud, who teaches necromancy, who teaches the work, therefore, of working with the dead, working with the ancestors, who is a servant of the goddess Minerva, who keeps an undying fire in the middle of Bath, and who is this winged being who rises into the sky and falls to earth on the temple of Apollo. You know, Trinovantum is London, but more reasonably, just outside Bath, is a great temple of Apollo that shares the name of Bladud, in a sense. The Apollo the wolf, Bladud the wolf lord. So here we're tapping into traditions. Again, we're not going to make the 18th century mistake of saying that means that. But what we see are resonances. Because the temple of Sulis Minerva in Bath is one of the great Romano-British temples. Now, the great advantage we have when we're looking at Romano-British tradition is that there is information. And so when we deal with a book like this, that is a genuinely magical book that is referring to aspects of Roman tradition, we can look at Roman tradition, we can look at, well, what's happened there, what has happened in Bath. And what we see is the figure of Minerva, Sulis Minerva, that is important in Geoffrey's book, is enormously important in Romano-British tradition. We also find Minerva invoked in the Vita Malini as the teacher of Taliesin and Mavithin. So what is pointed here, so if we think, if we follow the hints in this book, we get this hint of this is like the material that you find in Homer. This is like the stuff that Parmenides, who is Phylarchus, who is the lord of the lair, who takes us into the underworld, into the mystery, into the Barrow Deep. This is where this story begins, and then he takes us, having described this paradisical island, then he starts to locate us in places that tell us, well, this is like that. This ancient tradition that we have in Homer, you can find this here. And here is this priest king who teaches necromancy, who teaches us the way of working with the blessed and the unquiet dead. And the thing that's so interesting, I think, about Geoffrey's work, particularly if we look at these two works by Geoffrey, I love the Mabinogi. It's informed my whole life. We're going to spend a lot of time looking at it in these 3 years. But more magical than the Mabinogi are these two books by Geoffrey. And they remain almost completely unknown. Even though, they're talked about, but people look past them, partly because they're seen as being late, because they are 12th century, and people erroneously think of places, things like the Mabinogi, being much earlier than that, which they're not. That's the point about really getting things the right way up. And it is disillusioning, a bit disappointing perhaps, we do think, well, actually, what we know, nothing really. Nothing from ancient times at all, nothing. What we have is a patchwork of things that were stitched together in the 18th century. And before that, there are even the medieval sources we have, of course, happened in the context of Christianity. But we have an advantage when we look at the medieval material, because we're then dealing with biases that we know. And we have to be careful still about how we understand or how we interpret those biases, but there's information to go on. But having found what we do find within this are important magical keys, and both in the landscape and within ancient tradition. You know, sort of Bill Gray, as well as his worldwide vitriol, wrote an extraordinary vitriol called the Sangreal Sacrament, and he did a whole process of looking at the Grail. And part of the things that he looks at is that he looks at Gnostic texts, he looks at various things, and creates an essence out of that. Now that's what we're looking at when we look at this material. We look at you finding your own relationship to that material, creating your own connection to it, and your own particular way of working with these older traditions that are not based on some pure ancient tradition that's always been sitting there, but actually is an evolving, speaking rediscovery of something that if we talk to it, will talk back to us. And at the heart of this tradition really is this place of the descent into the body, descent into the earth, descent into the universe through the body, and the bringing together of what we might call the body of flesh and the body of dream, and therefore the coming together of human, of the solidity and the linearity of the cognitive mind with the intuitive mind, and in a certain sense we could say the coming together of the human and the fairy, or the human and the elf, or the human and the spirit. And out of that the generation of a third form. Now that's the material really that we find the Inklings working with, which again we'll tap into tomorrow, when we find Tolkien looking at the union of humans and elves, and the creation of something he calls the Second Song, which is the new thing that arises by the doing of that. This is this same kind of process. Now the Tolkien's writings, now what Tolkien says about his writings is that he's writing about ancient history, prehistory, before the world, at a time when the world wasn't round, when it was flat, and so he's saying that he has written this very ancient history, that yet is somehow relevant. And the whole point about these myth structures really is, do they speak back? Do they inform us? Do they take us into more deeply magical places in ourselves? And if they do, then they do their job. If they don't, well, then they're cul-de-sacs, and we could do without them. Because at the heart of this is a path of deconstruction. So what we find in the prophecy of Merlin, when we find the breaking apart of everything, which sounds awful, is actually the stripping away of all that obscures the eternal flame at the center of things. And the great thing is it's actually both in the landscape, in the places that we can visit, in the books that we can read, there are clear keys and pathways. But we just have to learn to pay attention in a certain way in order to do that. And in a certain sense, when you do that, there's an old Welsh phrase that "Ac y maint y mae'n anodd yn canu, mae fo gloeddus yn dod." When you listen in this way, the mountains will sing, and the lady will come. So there we are, right on time.
There's a book title for you, isn't it? The